You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Bill Dietz. Bill, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's good to be here.
So Bill, I'm going to start with a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
One way of defining me, it would be that I'm an artist. I've been painting in oils since I was a child. I became interested in drawing and painting when I was even younger than just a kid. My favorite present was a sketchbook.
Uh-huh.
And I'd sit in the car and draw if we were going for a ride or on a rainy day. It was amazing to me that you could invent anything you wanted to on a piece of paper, or at least it appeared that way to me.
Yeah.
So
that's one piece of who you are. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I define myself in different ways. Mm-hmm. I could define myself by being raised in a country small town, Bath, New York. Mm-hmm. And one of the greatest joys I had was to just go into the backyard and look up in the sky and kind of realize that sky was the same sky that people were seeing all over the world, nighttime skies. Mm-hmm. So just a curiosity about the world that extended out from this one little place that I was, but mm-hmm. Early on, very curious about looking beyond, mm-hmm. seeing a further hill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with that curiosity, grounded in place, grounded in sight, do we need to know anything else before we cut to music here, before we start?
Oh, just that I feel like I feel like I broke a lot of bonds. Mm-hmm. over years. I would I did go to college. I maintained my interest in art, and I did as a teacher for a while in Spencer Van Etten High School. Mm-hmm. As an art teacher. So I felt like I grew in many ways that when I was younger in that small town that I had no idea would be parts of my life.
Right. So it's the small town experience, the wider world, and it's a lot to sort out.
Yes. So, it's wonderful.
Yeah. So you brought some music with you. What should we play first?
Oh, one of the Vivaldi selections would be good.
Con mio delito. Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
was Nicola Benedetti playing Vivaldi. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Bill Dietz. So, Bill, why this music? And, you know, I mean, I'm going to make the obvious, and from Bath, New York.
Well, violin is a very beautiful instrument. I love to hear the sound of it. And I started listening to violin music when I was a child. My grandfather was a fiddler, square dance fiddler. Mm-hmm. And he would call the square dances and play music at the same time. Of course, his music was fiddling music,
right.
Appalachia, kind of French-Canadian style, and we would dance around the floor while he played his music on his visits. So the violin was a very beautiful sound, and he would sometimes, he was very interested in repairing the violins and talking about the violins and where they came from,
right.
And that the city of Cremona in Italy was the big city, and I heard names like Stradivarius, Amati, Guarnerius, and that was, you know, later became much more of an interest to me. And also created an interest in stringed instruments. I played the guitar and mandolin, and when I was in my 30s, I finally went back to see my grandfather to buy a violin from him. And it was a struggle. It took a long time to be able to play the violin or to somewhat, and I'm basically self-taught, and I've learned a lot. And recently, actually, in the last couple of years, I've made a couple of violins. So it's the violin has been a very big interest. And this music in particular, Vivaldi is very, it's soft, but it's got movements in it. It just carries me. And I've been to Venice, of course, Vivaldi was in Venice, and he trained many students and women who were needed a place to be, and he taught them how to play and become an orchestra, and they played in music, his music in the churches.
So Bill, I want to go back to your grandfather because it's such a poignant story. He's playing music of the masses in a certain sense, you know, folk kind of popular dance music, fiddle music, and but he's also a craftsman.
Yes,
was he one of your? Where did you learn about craft and art? Because I'm going to put those two things together because I think they live together in the same kind of space.
Well, I knew that he repaired the violins, but really, like crafts of doing things, might have come a little bit from my father, who always was building something in the yard, and he always made sure that we were around. My brother and I were around to watch so that he could kind of tell us, as he was doing it, he'd tell us how he was doing it.
Step
by step.
Right. When did you encounter Vivaldi?
Probably, I went to Venice in 2002 first with a friend of mine. We went to Italy and we did some painting there, and but it was a little bit before that. It was right around that time, I think.
Neat. But it was also kind of, you know, you're fully an adult at that point. You're in midlife,
right. Yes.
You know, and you're encountering it and taking it in. So what happened? How did you get from Bath to art college to art teaching in public schools to being now just an artist? That's your primary identity.
Well, it was a question in my mind, what am I going to do
in
my life? I'm really interested in painting and art. I was also interested in religion. I was brought up, in those days, I was a Catholic. I went to the Catholic Church. So I spent a summer reading the Bible and questioned whether I should become involved with the church somehow. And then I read a book about Vincent van Gogh, who was kicked out of his ministry because he was giving the church linen to people that were poor that needed to keep warm, and he was an art, he just kind of like started drawing on envelopes, and I became interested in his life and looking at his paintings and thinking about that kind of personality that has that deep interest in humanity, but then takes on this other way of depicting it and of doing something with it. And he was a very passionate person. Your question again was how do I get from a small town to
the career or the life of an artist? Because I grew up in a small town, and we had one person I guess in town who was, or maybe a few. They were older people. They were people who came of age around the early 20th century when the arts were viable in this rural community. But there really were the only quote artists that we had by the time I was really growing up were people who did more craft oriented stuff and not what would be considered, you know, art in terms of radical interpretation or real trying to create a set of visual associations that weren't just, in a certain sense, playing with what you already knew.
Well, my art teacher in high school was very good at bridging that gap because he had us study some art history and do some readings and writings about that. And my guidance counselor suggested that art is a great career, but it's hard to make money at it. So maybe when you go to college, you should definitely get involved with an art education program. So I did that, and at first, for the first few years out of leaving college, I did not use that. I was really intrigued with being an artist much more. I went to Towson State College in Baltimore, Maryland, where the art department wasn't one of the big departments, but it was definitely close to Baltimore, and there was a lot of information that I was receiving from the bigger world, the city world, and the art world. But I did do the art education classes and later used them in my teaching to get my job as a teacher, teacher.
Right, but when you were making a living as art, how did you do that?
Before I was the art teacher?
Yeah, before you went into teaching.
I didn't. I had to do a lot of jobs. Worked for the Department of Agriculture, collecting soil samples and arrowheads.
On the side, yeah.
Yes.
Right. And some of which I think you wear, right?
Sometimes I have one that's a very special one that I found, yes.
So, but you also you were talking at one point off air another time about having done commercial art that was more landscape of a more commercial nature.
Yes, for a while I wanted to learn how to do perspective, visual linear perspective, buildings. So I practiced that, and then I did commercial art. Really, I painted people's houses, doing paintings of people's houses and businesses, and I got a fair amount of work doing that, but it wasn't. It wasn't the only.
I couldn't make a living. I mean, I all of this is kind of touching different notes for me. Back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there were traveling artists who would go through, and for the more the wealthier farmers, they would paint their prize livestock, or they would paint their farmsteads or whatever. And that we have some of, or I don't, but some other relatives have kept some of those documents, and it's just kind of a fascinating thing. But I have no idea how much of a living they actually made, because they just kept moving from one place to the next, trying to make a go of it, and painting. So I want to, how have you had to change as an artist in order to kind of face the reality of making a living, but also how have you had to change, has the reality of making a living changed your art, or have you done that and now you're really focusing on your art as a separate matter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate. I feel very fortunate now that I retired and I have the time to explore painting in a more abstract, fine arts painting rather than thinking of it as a commercial endeavor.
Sure.
And do I really need to sell this painting? It would be great to, but I'm going to be okay if I don't, and it's more important to me. And that's not the main force in doing it at all.
Right.
In doing the painting. The painting is coming from exploring something about reality, something about that I want to communicate to others. Mm-hmm. So right now it's taking on a very abstract, I sometimes don't want to use the word abstract, I use the word non-objective, or because it's not really an object in there, but there right. have been many times, I mean, I went through a phase of doing paintings of dancers, mm-hmm. And so figurative work still is coming into right. my painting, and I don't want it to totally not be there, but right now I feel like I'm exploring some very interesting, exciting color, depth, and richness in the painting, and using different techniques that I have thought about before, but now I feel like I'm actually doing it.
Okay, and I'm what I see in your work is a lot of juxtaposition of color and the shape of the how the color is on the canvas that plays with each other and in ways, and out of that emerges images that we largely project into that. But it doesn't seem like you started with an image in mind,
right?
And so it's you know, in a formal sense it may be abstract, but it's I can see why you want to call it non-objective.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just gives us these incredibly rich colors. And what you have a show now at Padma that's up until
yes.
what, the end of this month,
or until the 26th or 25th yeah. of this month. Yes.
Yeah, and that show, what I noticed compared to the show you had earlier in the year was that there's more red. There are more mm-hmm. pictures with mm-hmm. red in them. Mm-hmm. And the red is balanced in a really interesting sort of way. It's not overwhelming. It's not angry. It's not hot. It's just present. Is there something about that you're trying to express with that color?
I find red a difficult color to work with because it is very... I mean, I do think that colors have an impact on your moods when you're looking at them. So I find blues very soothing.
Right.
So I tend to blues and blue greens a lot, but I notice that if I insert red, there's a certain excitement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so instead of having it being kind of like an angry feeling, if it can come in as kind of an accent and an excitement. So I have been exploring with that a little bit more. Same with yellow. Yellow is uh-huh. also a color that I have a hard time working with on its own.
Right.
I did landscapes for many years, and I found that the landscapes were largely blues and greens. And green is a combination of blue and yellow, which is not, I mean, it's a difficult color to work with. I mean, you see it all the time in nature, but somehow I started feeling kind of restricted when
right.
I was painting in the landscapes.
Yeah. And yellow by itself tends to put glare or distance or something.
Mm-hmm.
And but what I noticed about the reds in the pieces that had a particularly strong red was that it felt friendly and engaging
mm-hmm.
and passionate mm-hmm. in that way without being too hot to handle or in your face.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a really neat experience to have walking through and looking.
That's great to hear. different. It's nice to hear the viewpoints. I mean, the other night at the opening at Padma, listening to people's interpretation of my paintings
sure.
or asking questions of why I did this and what is my technique and how do I get to is uncovers. In a way, it's difficult for me to think about it, but when somebody actually asks me the question, it kind of... I find that I do have answers for
uh-huh.
it. I don't think about those. I'm not really conscious of them, but you know, having somebody ask me about it,
right,
it kind of brings it for
yeah,
brings
yeah.
it out.
Yeah, it's all there in the reservoir of your experience and your awareness.
Yeah.
What should we play next musically?
Oh, I have a selection. Do I have? How about the Nocturne, the Chopin?
Sure. Here we go.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Bill Dietz. So, Bill, how have you changed over the years? How have you changed in ways that you wouldn't have anticipated? You know, what has life given you to learn or to engage that you wouldn't have anticipated?
In the early 70s, I was living in an apartment, and some friends of mine moved up from Baltimore, and they wanted to move into the area, so they brought their belongings and they put their books on my bookshelves. And one time I was looking at this book, and it had a picture of a person on the end, and I thought it was a woman. The person had long hair, and I pulled the book off the shelf and discovered that it was the autobiography of a yogi, uh-huh, by Paramahansa Yogananda. And I looked into the front, and I noticed that his birthday was my birthday. So I said, oh, well, maybe I should find out what this guy is about. And uh-huh, I started reading it, and I could not put the book down. And it had a very strong impact and influence on me.
What captured you?
His vastness of his existence went so far beyond an individual. It started as an individual, mm-hmm, but it incorporated, and it was a very spiritual book, incorporated the universe, so, in a sense, a very big universal person.
Mm-hmm. So how did his person, what was the way that he told, or what were the stories or the use of language that gave this feeling of holding the universe, or opening the universe?
Being interested in the universe. There was no anger in this person. He was compassionate and always wanting to find a way to communicate love and compassion toward his fellow man. And also the book was full of very interesting characters, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, from India at that time. But it was
of his life,
yes.
So what I'm hearing is where many people have anger or that kind of tension as the driving force of a story, he had curiosity and compassion.
Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what was the effect on your life?
It took a while. I felt like over my life I've learned things and I've heard things and I have knowledge of things, but it wasn't immediate that I incorporated them into my life. I felt like it was changing me somewhat, but what's like in meditation in when I was in college, which is just a little bit before this time, mm-hmm, of reading,
sure,
this book, I kind of came to a place where I was trying to meditate on my own, and only years later do I feel like I've kind of get some of the things that that can happen to you in meditation that didn't at the time. I was still, you know, living the life of a young person, experiencing relationships, college. What was I going to do? The changing culture, the anti-Vietnam movement, all those other things, mm-hmm, came into the picture.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, with most profound shifts, oftentimes we don't even know the moment they began, but you have this book that's a touchstone for the beginning of the moment. Mm-hmm. What did the years look like? What were the changes in the way you perceived situations or people that changed as a result of that book? And I'm going to just, it's in full disclosure, I've been told I should read that book because it's an important book to read, mm-hmm, and I have never gotten around to reading it.
Well, that's the part where I feel like it didn't happen immediately, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, but over time, you know, it keeps coming back to me. And I studied that whole line of thinking for a while. I actually was getting lessons from the Self-Realization Fellowship, which is Yogananda's mm-hmm, organization. And it every time I would read something, it would kind of click with me. It would bring me new insights, But I think sometimes intellectually taking something in and actually taking it in your life. I mean, there was I raised children, you know, in that time. Sometimes you get very wrapped up into the specifics, and you kind of forget those things that kind of come to you.
The context things, right. Yeah, the bigger context. So you were pulled into the passion of the anti-Vietnam War era,
yes.
And the closing down of the civil rights era and the anti-war era,
mm-hmm.
and that movement. And what about that preoccupation made meditation or made these insights slower to come for you? Because I don't necessarily think it was young, because I was young, but I was in a different era where all of those anti-war things were passed and people were kind of lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going through a cultural dislocation from rural poverty to Cornell. And for me to find meditation was to find a powerful sense of peace and muscular relaxation,
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, it wasn't anything about thinking. It was all about just mm-hmm. profound, deep relaxation.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think the anti-war movement had a lot of anger still involved. Mm-hmm. War is an angry response to reality.
Right.
And for me, it was like, why would people want to involve themselves in that? And think that I was going to be forced to become part of that. I think I had to have a lot of reaction against it. And that kept me kind of in a more forceful stance of like no,
right,
like a
right.
lot of no,
right. Yeah, your finger right. out against the mm-hmm. the forces.
And you know, I read the history, the American history of the destruction and of the American Indian, and several books, and was totally outraged with the fact that America cannot claim to not have a lot of pretty ugly history.
Right. No. Yeah. And there's not a nation out there that doesn't right. have ugly history.
Right.
But yeah. No. And we can't delude ourselves. What you were as you were talking about the angry times. That anger, in terms of kind of just the cultural milieu of the time, that anger shifted from anti-war to kind of. Upwardly mobile professionals, and the anger either dissipated or went away into consumption, on a broad cultural level, and then there were some of the people who felt that their legitimate values were scoffed at, wounded, or whatever, who became the next wave of anger. On the right,
and
you're making me appreciate how we've just kind of kicked the ball of anger back and forth,
mm-hmm.
And we haven't really dealt with it as a nation, and I hadn't thought about it in that light before, mm-hmm. What mm-hmm. that means. How has being an artist, I mean, this is a hard question to ask, partly because in your relationship with your children and with your spouse, being an artist is tough,
mm-hmm.
because it's kind of hard for kids to know what to say. I mean, I do a lot of different things. I don't call myself an artist. That would have been easier for my children, but they would then ask, where's the art? and I would have to say, well, it's in these programs or in these activities that have a kind of an improvisational quality to them. And then they would look at me and they would roll their eyes and mm-hmm. just say, you know, you're nuts, Dad. So how has being an artist affected you, who you are as a father and who you are as a partner?
I think maybe seeing myself as an artist is almost a separate kind of like view of myself, and being a family person is something I'm very I feel comfortable with, because it's like it seems like a natural flow of being a human being is to have children,
uh-huh.
and really in a lot of ways I always felt like you can't tell your kids what to do.
Right.
And
you certainly didn't want to be told what to do.
Right. And I didn't want to be told what to do. So why would I expend a lot of energy in trying to make my kids into something and let them evolve and be an example myself of loving them, caring for them, uh-huh. and that will be the message that they'll get, that they're...
But did they see you pursue your art or just stop to make more of a living when you needed to make more of a living and to build a pension all those kinds of things?
One time my son did ask me, you know, when I became a teacher, actually, even before that, I worked at a furniture factory called Mackenzie Childs for 6 months. And my son at that point Raphael asked me, is this part of your career? And I thought, so he definitely has a perception. He's trying to figure out what my career is.
Right, because that's the big language for this generation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And I think once I finally became an art teacher, he even saw that more as, okay, you know, this is the career. So that's his mindset, you know, of thinking. But I never really gave too much thought about how are my children seeing me as an artist, because it's not something I immediately... I think there's misconceptions about, you know, about how people see an artist.
Sure.
I kind of like fell under the spell of when I was young to see an artist as this kind of like a person that is interpreting mm-hmm. the world. Mm-hmm. So, and in a way, any of us could do that.
Oh, we all do that in little ways all the time.
Right. I chose to have like a medium, which mm-hmm. is the painting, as a manifestation. Like what you were saying, you didn't have anything to show except for the radio programs or something. But, you know, so maybe it meant something to me to have this physical representation mm-hmm. of something I was trying to explore. And also that's why the commercial art eventually just didn't really hold up as a thing for me to do. I mean, it was a way to be in the world and make some money. And many people find that as an avenue of great success. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of times I saw myself as an artist, as being the artist is kind of almost like a separate personal thing.
It's your work, and it's kind of apart from your family. And that's a very, very much a late 20th century approach to family life, that our work is separate some in many ways mm-hmm. From our family life. I was listening to the story of your father wanting you to observe, but I was more like you were observing his projects in the yard rather than helping them with him.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't put your children in the position of having to observe you, at least from the way you told the story. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a gift to them, but also it was a way of holding kind of sacredly or separately your own space.
Mm-hmm.
So that's neat. That's really neat. What should we play next, musically?
Have we got a couple more time slots?
Oh, yes, we've got, yeah.
Okay, well, let's go back to Vivaldi.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Bill Dietz. So, Bill, you picked all of these beautiful violin pieces, but I know that you have an incredible interest in music that's pretty wide-ranging. What was going on here?
Yes, in thinking about choosing music for a show that would represent something about me, I've been listening to a variety of genres over the years. And at first I was thinking maybe something country, something Irish, Cajun, gypsy, and which are all folk musics.
Right, yeah, yeah.
From the people, and a lot of times it's dance music.
And close to your grandfather, I sense, on some level.
And my grandfather would always criticize me when I tried to play a folky Bob Dylan thing, and he said, well, how are people going to dance to this?
I think he cared about their bodies, their movement.
It was all about the square dance for him.
And
getting people up and moving. And that folk music, you know, when you listen, even the ones that I've... I was listening to a lot of Cajun music, but it really is about the same thing. It's the dance. When you go to Grassroots or someplace and there's a Cajun band, it's constant. It's like a waltz to a faster tune, and the various genres are about that kind of thing, which sometimes I wonder if people like Vivaldi and Mozart weren't folk musicians of their time. However, the people weren't really listening to that music. That was kind of the king's music.
Right.
But it gave them an opportunity to explore this avenue of sound, which is based on something that had to come out of their history. I mean, they had Mozart could use violins because violins existed.
Right. But the quality, I mean, when I listen to the pieces that we've played thus far, there is a meditation quality to them, which isn't necessarily true of all other classical music. I was thinking one of my favorite forms of music is Renaissance lute fantasias, which are only about a minute and a half to 2 minutes long, and they're a solo instrument and a solo voice, and it's just incredible for me. That's what I need in terms of music, in terms of being recentered emotionally and physically with a really clean break. Now, they were all funded. They all had patrons who funded them, but they also sang for others than their patrons too, as part of their traveling about.
Yeah. I think it is the meditative aspect of a lot of this music that I've chosen, that I listen to a lot when I paint, is that it creates space, and it's again, it's soothing, but it's rich. I mean, listen to Vivaldi. I mean, he just takes you places, and you imagine this flowing back and forth. I've heard it. He said that, you know, his music is very Venetian, and that the waves of the ocean are constantly washing against the old buildings.
Right,
and you have this back and forth and in and out feeling.
Yes. So, and this is pretty as direct a lead-in as I've ever had. What do you do to take care of yourself, and on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, yearly, physically, emotionally, intellectually, and how is art part of your self-care?
That's a big question.
It's a huge question.
In the last 3 years, I've come back to doing some yoga at the fitness center, and at first it was slow, but it's been very good physically. It's been excellent to revitalize my feelings of youth and being, my body is feeling much better.
More limber.
Limber. And also there's an aspect to some yoga and to the yoga I've been doing of it brings in the body. It's not just leaving the mind and, mm-hmm. the, and the spirit out of the picture. It's very much part of it. So that is definitely one thing. And I've also been doing some Tai Chi there, and that is a balancing, it's an Asian way of looking at movement. It's a very flowing, natural. The teacher was always talking about nature and kind of like how a wild animal moves.
Sure.
Without this thought, you know. You know, you're moving in ways, there is a form that we mm-hmm. and there's many forms, but you know, so in his form, we do have a form that we kind of follow, but he also intersperses a lot of exercises that teach me about how my body can be balanced more. And I find that I'm using it if I go dancing or even if I'm walking down the street and I'm turning around to look at something, I'll move differently now than I did before.
And what is the difference?
That I'm more aware of my feet and placement, and how that is, you know, how that influenced the turn of my body all the way up through my legs and my hips and my shoulders. And it's not just a, you know, a ripping and turning around, which pulls things. It's kind of a flow that you have to, you kind of like start to see your body as a continuum of movement.
Right. And what I'm the language is coming to me is it's a graceful move as opposed to a kind of jerky
yes.
move, mm-hmm. which can damage. I'm curious, how does, I think for generations we've where work became less physical and more cerebral.
Mm-hmm.
We lost how to use our bodies in ways that were really good for them, and so that when people do them, they will do movements that really aren't sustainable, that lead to, you know, repetitive strain, or, you know, we've gotten desks now that people can stand at and move
right.
around. We've had to recover a lot that we've lost over the last 100-150 years in terms of the body.
Right.
How does that? Does that play into how you use your space as a painter?
It does. I recently bought a chair which is has rollers
uh-huh.
and it's very comfortable. And I was standing at the easel, always standing at the easel. And there's something about standing which gave me a lot of movement. But I found in this chair, I can push myself back and roll around and get my paints and come back to the easel. And that's kind of relieving some of the back and shoulder strain that I was having.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So, and I think yoga actually brought me to realizing that there was something, you know, after I painted for an hour, that there was, that I might stop painting because I wasn't comfortable anymore.
Right, right.
So, is
so you
there
needed
a way?
To sit as opposed to
right,
stand or
right.
vary it
more.
Yeah.
Yeah, more variation.
Yeah.
So, and painting is a very it's still kind of thing. So trying to move when I'm doing it more, mm-hmm. Maybe even using I'm left-handed, so maybe even using my right hand,
mm-hmm.
Which is very difficult. I can't get the same flow, but I mean it's a possibility. You know, I've thought it.
Right. I mean, it's something you could play with.
Right.
And
exactly.
Then, yeah. In terms of the technique of applying the paint, and that's also a physical motion. Has that
right.
has that changed with the yoga, or have you, or actually that has that changed with this as your style of art has changed?
Yeah, well, it has a lot to do with the style that I'm choosing right now, and going back to instead of being very tight with it, like trying to get each brush stroke, almost so you can't see the brush strokes, which was techniques used by the old masters
right.
a lot of times and loosened up over the years with the French Impressionist. so kind of letting go of some of those historical techniques mm-hmm. and just exploring this form that I'm using right now, which is a lot, it's, you know, so people have said, oh, abstract expressionist, you know, something, they'll say something about Jackson Pollock.
Right.
And I don't feel like my work is that. But I can certainly see how it kind of lends itself to someone. I mean, I'd probably go more toward thinking about Kandinsky, who was much earlier than that, around 1919, mm-hmm. Russian painter, who the story is that he had one of his paintings leaning up in his studio upside down, and he walked by it and he said, "Oh, wow." He saw something there that he didn't see when the painting was right side up. So he kind of went in an explorative, abstract direction, non-objective direction. And his colors and his way of breaking up spaces sometimes mm-hmm. became, you know, as I looked at it, and this is only within the last, you know, maybe 10 years, right. 15 years that I've started exploring some of these other artists that were early initiators of non-objective art.
Right. So there's an old saying, and I'm forgetting the author of the poem, teach us to care and not to care. And there's a way in which you're applying the color to the canvas is caring and not caring, because the shapes or the forms that come out with any individual color, this feels a little bit random mm-hmm. in a certain sense, but it's applied with both care and not caring, so that you can see in it a whole host of things. That's my experience of it. What I want to come back to the earlier question, though. What do you do to take care of yourself emotionally and intellectually? We've got it physically, mm-hmm. but what do you do in these other realms?
I find that nature is very nourishing,
uh-huh.
and if things seem a little confusing, and I finally make the decision to drive to a place where I can walk in the woods, or walk in nature,
sure.
then I can get much calmer, and I can have a conversation with myself and not being concerned. Definitely don't want to take my cell phone into the woods and start doing something with that. There, you know, it's a time to actually let all and hear the sound of the birds and the randomness of trees growing up around me. It's very calming.
And you and so many people are healed or restored in that way. You said that when you finally convince, I don't know what the word you was, when you finally decide that you're going to do it, what makes you decide that you need to go into the woods? When do you realize that's the thing you have to do?
When I realize that I'm kind of getting in my own way of sorting things out, and I'm at the end of a decision-making process. It's sort of like I think I was reading about this. Is it freer to have decisions? And starting to look at it in terms of, like, instead of decisions, it's attractions.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, what's really attracting me right now? What's pulling me? And then go with that.
Yeah,
don't think about it at all anymore after that. Just go for it.
Right. Commit to the motion. I mean, that's very kind of Tai Chi and Zen.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, that's neat. That's neat. And
somebody asked me the other night at my art show, well, what's your favorite painting? You know, thinking that I was going to say in the show. And I said, I don't have one. And then I immediately said, no, that's not true. My favorite painting is the one I'm working on.
That's exactly, yeah. That's that, yeah, yeah. And then you let it go.
Mm.
And then, like all your children, it's just out there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Bill, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Oh, it's been nice to be on the show.
And what should we close with?
Massenet?
Sure. And here we go.